you for taking a ride on the Freedom Train, your community resource podcast series. I'm your conductor, Joseph Warden. As always, ride with me is my man, Patrick Irvin. Shout out to Jamie Basham. He's going to be joining us a little later. But it's all good. Make sure you maintain with us. Remember, the Freedom Train is sponsored by PAX, Inc. That's P-A-C-T-S-I-N-C. And PAX, Inc. is a black advocacy organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with a trace of hard work, honesty, and integrity. And for more information, make sure you visit www.paxinc.org, and that's P-A-C-T-S-I-N-C.org. Also, visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com to learn more about us, your hosts, and to hear the playbacks of your favorite shows. Also, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at _FreedomTrain. And while you're at it, subscribe to the Freedom Train on iTunes and Google Play Music so you can be down with us and never, ever, ever, ever miss a show. Pat!
Turn me up on my headphones.
There you go, man. I'm like, you be Jay-Z, I be Guru. Let's do this. One take. Yeah, man. How you feeling today, man?
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? A little bit like that.
Hey, man, if anybody feel you, I feel you.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody feel you. So, you know, we got another good one in store for today. I think the people are going to enjoy this one because we got the gentleman we interviewing, Dr. Samori Swaggart. He has so many different things. It's like connecting Voltron and just... that's him, and he's just bringing all of it to you because he's so multifaceted, and he has basically taken over the world in so many different ways. So,
hey Joe,
what's up?
Joe, make that sound again.
That. Psh.
Oh, okay. the word for the day is porn.
The porn. Right. Yes, that is the word for the day. I like that. Ooh. I like that. You know
Ooh.
What?
Ooh.
There it is. So, Dr. Samori Swaggart is here. What's going on, Doc?
The doc is in the building. What's good?
Yeah, man. We're excited. I'm ready for the people to you know, get a hold of what you are doing, because you're doing a lot, but you're doing it big, though.
The studio audience is messing up already.
No, they not. See, Pat, you jumping the gun.
No,
you jumping the gun.
When he come in like that with that, the doc is in the building, you can feel that it's supposed to be the studio audience, a bomb dropping and all kind.
You know what? I'm just press buttons for you, okay?
Because
There you go. You know what? I'm going to give you a drum roll and everything. I'm going to give you what you want. There you go.
We ain't never had a guest ever in the 3 years we've been doing the show. We ain't never had a guest do that. You missed it.
Mm. Okay. All right. Hold on. All right. You got to do it again.
You got to do it again. No.
Hey, you know what, Pat? When I see you, hey, man, we're going to break dance battle when I see you. All right, you better be ready. You better have that little cutoff shirt that Ice-T had on in that movie. You better be ready.
Electric Boogaloo.
There you go.
All right.
So I want to give the people a little background information about you, Doc, before we jump all the way into everything that you have. So we have a guy straight out of Brooklyn, straight out the BK, raised in Queens. So you know his hip hop knowledge has to be rich. Coming up in Brooklyn and in Queens, but he's also a doctor of pharmacy, and he received his doctor of pharmacy in 2007 from Howard University. He's an author, he's a poet, he's a performer, he's also a correspondent on the Your Black World with Dr. Boyce Watkins. I mean, he's just taking over the world. And see, Pat, I'm gonna do it right for you this time. This is how you want it. I want to give you Dr. Samori Swaggart. See, Pat? See, you jumped the gun. I had this, okay?
Whatever.
Oh, man. Y'all are something else. But, yeah, but no, you're right, though. The doc is in the building. 100%
yes, sir.
With y'all.
Yes, sir. We appreciate you. We appreciate you, man. All right, Pat.
It's on you. Let's do this.
All right. And I want everybody to keep in mind the word of the day is porn.
P-O-R-N.
All right.
Ain't no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
No way.
So we are speaking to a Renaissance man.
Mm-hmm.
So as a black man in America today, what does it mean to be a Renaissance man? Somebody, you know, that brings as much to the table as you do. How did you get to be as multifaceted as you are?
That's a good question. I think really, really honestly, it's just exposure to the universe, society, and just seeing everything that's going on in society. You know, when we say Renaissance, man, Renaissance, when you look at definition-wise, it means like revival or rebirth. And so I kind of always looked at what I go through in stages. So many things that I'm doing, I have my hands in so many different pockets. I'm wearing so many different hats on my head. And it's kind of like each hat I put on, each pocket I put my hand in, it's like I'm giving rebirth to myself. So it's kind of like, you know, I do pharmacy. I got my doctor's of pharmacy. So I'm a critical care, intensive care unit pharmacist in the hospital. That's one hat. That's one pocket I'm in. I do poetry. I do rhyme. I do writing. I'm an author. I do, like you said, with Dr. Boyce Watkins and Financial Juneteenth, doing social analysis and commentary, geopolitical analysis, things of that nature. January, I should be having a radio show coming up. I'm working on two documentaries. I have a music album out, you know, working on a second one. So it's a rebirth. You know, it's kind of like I'm not just a pharmacist. No, I kind of gave birth to myself in all these different venues of life. And so that's that rebirth, that's that revival. And so it's kind of like I'm walking that path in each one, separate worlds, but it's still on the same body. So it is that Voltron that Joseph was talking about. So, it, you know, where it all comes from, I don't know. The universe just gives me downloads. I take it and walk with it if it's positive. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
That's what's up, man. You got to.
I don't know if Voltron make that sound that Joe made though.
Hey man, look, you got to go back and watch the cartoon. See, okay.
That was a dope cartoon. I grew up on that.
Yes, sir. But man, it's just cool because I see a lot of young black men who have never met somebody like you. And if they have met somebody like you, they don't know. And what you exemplify is somebody who was told from the beginning about the limitless possibilities that you have, and you took that to heart and just kept putting one foot in front of the other to make sure that you can have as many experiences, and you literally can do what you want to do despite this oppressive system that we under.
You know, and what you just said underscores another reason why it's important that every black man in America that's alive today needs to be a Renaissance man, because they're closing the doors, they're tightening the screws, they're increasing the pressure, trying to constrict our growth and our potential. And so it's kind of like you have to be more than just this one entity, this one being, this one purpose. You got to be a man of many operations in this matrix, you know. So you got to... You have to be diverse, and so that's one key thing that I think young black men need to take away from this. Be diverse as you can and try to maximize it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So I'm particularly interested in this question because for my day job, I do HIV/AIDS outreach, and I basically over the last 3-4 years, I've basically trained over maybe 600 pharmacy students in HIV/AIDS outreach testing and things, and I've been able to interact with those students and kind of see what brought them on these particular paths, because I see them from all different walks of life. So, you know, that's another eye-opening experience that I'm having. So what inspired you to become a part of the medical field and to specifically pursue, you know, take the time to pursue a doctorate of pharmacy?
To be succinct and to be real, I want to deal in drugs. No, I'm joking with you. Hey, wait a minute, man. You went sideways with it. No. No, honestly, I think it started with childhood curiosity. I vividly remember being like a young kid, elementary school. I would lock myself inside my parents' bathroom, and I would just open up their, like, medicine cabinet, and I would just, like, make my own concoctions just to see, you know, what the hell this stuff does. You know, like, I could take Alka-Seltzer, like, okay, well, Alka-Seltzer bubbles in water. Does it bubble in and rubbing alcohol? And, you know, just things. Just, my mind was just, it was just fascinated with science, you know. And
right.
I think what really sealed the deal, though, was, like, I went to Hampton where I got my bachelor's of biology and my master's in medical science. When I went to Hampton, I knew I wanted to do, at first I wanted to do business. That was just at first. And then it was my second semester, I switched over to biology. And so, you know, did biology, it was good. You know, I'm getting to like my last year, and they have what's called these different health career programs. So I went to one in Case Western Reserve Medical School in Ohio, and then I went to one in VCU in Richmond, Virginia. And both of them, what they do is they give you exposure, a little bit of introductory hands-on training in the different healthcare areas. And so you were there getting, you know, they would teach you about the different courses that you would take, like your first year of pretty much any healthcare school, like, you know, when you talk about medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, whatever. And I was surrounded by all these first-year medical students, pharmacy students, and it was just seeing young, and they were all black, and
right.
seeing them, young blacks doing their thing, maybe about 3 or 4 years older than me, it was very inspirational. One thing that really got me towards pharmacy was that it was, you know, doing the research on it. I was like, you know, I know myself. Having understanding yourself is a big thing. I know myself. I know that I like to do other things. I like to have a variety assortment in my life of options. I was thinking about med school at first, and then as I'm talking, as I remember from Case Western in Ohio, and then I'm at VCU in Virginia, they, you know, I'm talking to the pharmacy school students, and they're like, well, you know, med school is nice, you know, you're still working in the medical field and all, but you really have more time to yourself. And so I'm thinking, I'm like, you know, you graduate from med school, then you got to do your internship, you got to do your residency, you got to do your fellowship. And then I'm like, I don't really want to do all of that, you know. And then on top of that, you got to come home, and you're still on call after working 36 hours. I'm like, nah, I want something where I can go in, do my job, serve the people I need to serve, and then have a life to actually do the other things that my heart desires. So that played a big part. And then my fraternity brother was also a pharmacist too. And so he kind of played a big part in pushing me towards there. So I applied. Well, I took the test. I knocked that out like in the top 90th percentile.
Man,
I was like, that's it. I'm out. So that's the story.
Congratulations, man. That's what's up. That's what's up. Because it's not easy. It's not easy. And I see the time and the commitment that people have to put into getting that doctor of the pharmacy, man. So congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
That as well. I didn't realize that program was as difficult as it was until I worked at the years back. I worked at the Department of Health Central Pharmacy, and we used to get the FAMU pharmacy students would come and intern over there. And, you know, we just talking to them and listening to their stories and listening to them talk about the workload and this, that, and the third.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those kids, I swear, I'd say about 60% of them were graying prematurely. They were stressed out. They were running ragged. They would come in just looking dead and tired. And be like, what's wrong with you? I was up all night working on the paper, studying for this, doing that. I said, oh, God. So, that's it. It's a workload.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. That's no lie.
So,
no lie.
So, you earned your doctorate in pharmacy, your PharmD, and then you're a best-selling poet. So talk to us a little bit about the poetry thing. When did you start writing poetry? When did it first hit you that you might be good enough to actually sell some of your poems? Like, when did all that happen with the poetry?
That started from the womb.
Okay.
They actually have, so like, I was born in Brookdale Hospital in Brooklyn, and they were ahead of their time. They were ahead of their time in 78. They actually have video footage of the birth, so the parents can always go back and see the birth. And when I looked at the footage, when my mom gave birth to me, the first thing that came out was a pen. And then I came out holding the pen. And that's when I'm just messing with you, man.
I was like, what?
No. 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 I think the what got me on my path was my mom. She was an African-American history teacher in New York City public school system. And she will always, ever since I can remember, like first and second grade, she would have me memorizing poems by black poets. So I'd be memorizing poems by Langston Hughes, County Cullen, Claude McKay, things like that, brothers during the Harlem Renaissance. And it expanded my mind outside of just what I was learning in school, you know. I wasn't learning anything like that in my elementary school. And then I think what really got when I started writing for real, I was probably fifth grade. You know, rap was real big back. You know, I mean, rap's still big, but you're trying to write raps and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I think when I got to the high school, two things happened. You know, the girl I was dating at the time, sucker for love. I used to write her poetry, whatever, but she really, really enjoyed it. Like, she loved it for real. And she would tell her mom about it. She would tell her dad about it. Like, you know, and then I'd come by and visit. They'd be like, oh, you know, when I heard about your poetry, I would write, you know, some stuff would be love poetry, and then some stuff was just about my views on the world. And I was like, wow, you know, they really seemed like they had a real interest. And then what happened was I always look at rap as just poetry sped up sometimes, because like Rakim was saying, R.A.P., rhythm and poetry, R.A.P.
Right.
We did a talent show, and we tore it down. It was like me and three of my boys, you know, so we rocked the house. And I was like, all right, so, you know, I got a little something here. When I went to Hampton, you know, college, they have like, you know, poetry nights and stuff like that. I would, you know, I'll get up there and I'll perform my poetry, read my poetry, and you could see people feeling it. You can feel the love in their clapping and the shouting and stuff. I'm like, I got this. And so that accumulation of people really resonating with you, it encourages you more to continue. And I started discovering myself more and more. I would write more and more. I went to Howard, where that's when I really started putting pen to pad real heavy. There's a famous restaurant chain in D.C. called Busboys and Poets. I perform there like every week. You know, the crowd is loving it. They had like this campus-wide talent show. I'm like, all right, I'm going to get into this. You know, and you had people up in there that was rapping, dancing, playing instruments. And I went in, I tore it down. You know, I won first place, got $200, standing ovation from the auditorium. I'm like, yo, I can do this. Like, let's just do it. And so my last year of pharmacy school, I actually wrote a book of poetry my last year of pharmacy school, you know, so that was tremendous. So, you know, I could say it started for my mom, you know, schooling me on Harlem Renaissance poets all the way up to now.
And
it's still a work in progress.
Right. But that's cool. You've already laid the groundwork. You went out there and paid your dues, so it's just time to take it further now, so. That's what's up, man. So, within your bio, you were, and this question is for people who have no idea what these are. So you talk about various poetic techniques and alliterations. And so for those mm-hmm. of us who are kind of lost on that, can you further take us, you know, explain to us what, how you use these techniques and alliterations and why they should be used or why you use them?
Yeah, okay. So, in my book of poetry, so I published my book of poetry, and the book of poetry is called Black Eye on America. And it just gives like a lot of insight on just my views on social situations. And, you know, I was thinking of like different ways in which you can communicate or express your poetry while being creative. I can talk about, you know, the disparities, the economic disparities, the healthcare disparities that goes on in the country, race and everything. But how can I make it unique and make it stand out? And so, you know, just thinking back to things. So alliteration basically is a technique in which it's a repetition of sounds that precede a word. So it's kind of like the perfect example is Sally sold seashells by the seashore. That's mm-hmm. alliteration right there. Mm-hmm. And so I'll give you, if you give me a little bit, I'll give you like a few quick stanzas from a poem I did inside my book. It's called Big City Alliteration.
Go ahead. We was going to ask you to do one anyway, so.
Oh, okay. Cool. So I'll give you a little bit. So it goes like this. Mm-hmm. While wealthy whites wonder and worry why they work for wages to subsidize wicked women's welfare, African-American activists argue about allocation of affirmative action awards for animalistic acts and abuse against African ancestors that attributed to agricultural affluence. But behind big bolted boardroom doors, busy businessmen are bickering and brokering big bets and bargains in big buildings, making substantial financial killings. But below busy businessmen and big buildings exists a barrio where bums barter batteries and beverages or borrowing a bootleg between busy intersections to put boots and band-aids on blistering boils on the bottoms of bare feet while fighting for funds to finance food to feed their family and fuel future physical fixes. Meanwhile, in metropolis, metropolitan police patrol provide protection for pedestrians on pavement and public places, placing panhandling paupers and paddy wagons, partnering with peddlers and panders and prostitutes while passing out tickets for improper parking. So that's just that's just like a few lines from that poem. It's a longer poem, but that use of alliteration.
Right.
I also will give you, so like there's also a poem inside the book called Abbreviation Nation. So okay. I use abbreviations to kind of, just go through things. So I'll give you just a quick sample of this second verse from there. It's kind of has like a hip-hop delivery to it, but you know, it's
okay.
So you kind of get the feel. So it's like you have to listen out for how I'm using abbreviations. So it's like schooling MCs like SATs, GEDs, SLLs, and PhDs, plus the game's mental like OCD, PTSD, and ADD. MC, I'm deaf, they steal in my lines, I think I mean ADT. Come on, lyrics be the bomb like WMD, C4, and TNT. FBI, CIA, DEA, and ATF. Atlanta PD and other agencies swooped in on BMF. What about me, man? You must be high on LSD, PCP, ecstasy, THC, can't forget that crystal meth, or another other drug by the FDA, GNC, and CVS. Plus another time like PM and AM, want cash money like YM and CM, rock radio from FM to AM, no joke more serious than XM, move like a GS or SUV with a V6 and an HOV to escape APBs by the NSA, KGB, MI6, and TMZ. I'm old and new school like VCR, CDs, DVDs, and MP3s, HIV, HPV, plus you got the clap, that's 3 VDs, wishing before like ESP, that shit was poison like BBD, now you're in the ER, in the ICU, getting CPR by the MD, and the IV full of that AZT while connected to an EKG, please. And so that's just kind of like, you know, so just using different themes or techniques to convey messages or just style, whatever the case may be. So,
right.
So yeah,
right.
It's just different things.
Pat.
Yo.
You know how we always have in our hip-hop conversations, we talk about technical soundness and technical abilities and how
I was thinking about that when he started on alliteration.
Man, look here. I'm just saying he dropped some of the hottest verses this year. I'm just saying. You know.
Right.
Because you know we're always frustrated with the music, but we're always talking about, you know, how rappers rapping and the different ways you can say, because you know how some people get like Kendrick Lamar, he's very technically sound versus like a J. Cole, so a lot of people overlook what J. Cole says because of how he said
right.
it and look at more so what Kendrick, but it's like if people understand alliterations and poetic techniques, that's something that will help this generation or next generation actually have better techniques when it comes to actually the art and stuff. So those like basic
that's
skills.
Right.
That's wow.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
I was just thinking in terms of, because I was interested in how he was going to use alliteration, and I was really happy that you chose to give an example, and I was even mm-hmm. more happy and impressed that this shit was banging. because we hear nowadays when rappers trying to sound like they dropping bombs or whatnot, they like alliteration is a favorite technique. But the difference mm-hmm. is they just using a bunch of random words that have the same, you know, that start with the same letter. But when you actually mm-hmm. write it out, it don't mean anything. You just took a bunch of A
right.
words, stuck them together, and now everybody going crazy because all of the words start with the same letter.
Right.
But you ain't said nothing.
Right.
So to hear mm-hmm. you doing that, and then at the same time, the words actually have meaning and importance, and the phrases continue, and it's actually one coherent, you know, line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like that's powerful. Like, y'all need to rewind that and play that back.
Right. I mean, you know what it reminds me of? It's like some white girl had a video out, and she was breaking down different rhyme techniques and styles, and going from Rakim to like some of the rappers now, and just, you know, breaking down how they organize everything. But it's like you just spit that, just like it's nothing. So it's like when it's ingrained in you and you actually take the time to study the real techniques and everything and master that, that makes you so much better on your end when you actually give a final product. So hats off to you, my mm-hmm. brother.
Well, thank you, bro. I appreciate y'all. Seriously, I really, really do. Seriously.
Yes, sir.
No, that was dope.
Yes, that sir.
Was, I'm going to run that back soon as we finish.
I know, right?
Word.
All right. Man. Word for the day. What's our word for the day?
Porn.
There you go.
Porn.
Yeah. Don't forget.
Everybody loves it.
All right.
All right, Joe.
Now it's on you, man. Until you look at you. You're getting old.
I am getting old. I really am. I am. I'm going to be the big.
No, don't say that, man. We don't say we getting old. We getting ripe, like fruit. We get ripe.
I like that. No flies. All right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, you released the number one best selling poetry album on Amazon, titled "The Keyword for the Day."
Porn.
Porn.
In 2015, can you? So talk to us a little bit about that album and why you chose to go with
porn.
The name Porn. And I know it's an acronym, so, you know, y'all don't get too excited, you know. So just tell us what's going on with the porn.
All right. So, yeah, you know, I do porn. I do porn really good. So we released it in August of 2015. And so it was a number one bestseller on Amazon under the category of The Quiet Storm. And it was very serious because it hit number one, I think, four times. And literally, like, so in the Quiet Storm category, this is where you think of, like, you know, all your smooth stuff, knowing when you're with your lady, or, you know, ladies, if you listen, you with your man, y'all got the candles, whatever, and y'all playing all the good stuff. Like, literally, I seen it climb, like, from, like, the bottom entry, you know, into, like, the hundreds, all the way to the top. Marvin Gaye had his Hear My Dear album. It was next to mine in the number two spot. Voicemail was in the number three. Like, it was good, you know, and it was short-lived. Like, it was, I think it was like that for, like, a few days. Then, of course, you know, it dropped down, and it picked back up. And I was like, the album was battling, you know, it was doing good. So just to see my album, like, I had to take a screenshot of it. Just to see my album at number one and Marvin Gaye at number two and Boyz II Men at number three, like, I was like,
wow,
this is cool.
Right.
I'll take that. But so the album's called Porn, and it stands for poetry, oration, rhythm, and narratives. And it was an album that was birthed out of heartache. It was birthed out of heartache, and at the same time it was birthed out of just something I kind of always wanted to do. I had just ended, like, you know, a serious relationship of a female that I had, you know, we had a very serious relationship. And it was just like, you know, you see, like, artists, music artists, they really, when they have their catharsis, it's probably one of the best albums you hear, like people say that about Mary J. Blige. I was down in Hampton, Virginia at the time, and, you know, I was visiting my mom, and, you know, I'm writing down all these thoughts and emotions about, you know, the relationship that I just, you know, kind of got out of, on top of just thoughts randomly that was unrelated to that, but still along that vein. And so the theme people need to think about when they think of this album called Porn, it stands for poetry, oration, rhythm, narratives, but it's also in that vein of real sophisticated intimacy, romance, erotica. I go there and also take it to the realness. Like, I'm a show you the mirror of yourself. I'm going to force you to do real introspective analysis. I'm going to force you to be truthful. When you talk about love and intimacy, how real are you? Are you really about that life, or are you just about the physical part? So that album balances that truthfulness about love while at the same time mixing up that intimacy. And what happened real quick, so I won't be too long-winded, is one day I was sitting outside on the porch when I was in Hampton, and where we stay is like right over the bridge from the university. So whenever the Hampton University band plays called The Force, you can hear the horns and the drums and everything. I was like, man, you know, I kind of always want to do some album where I have just like live instrumentation and stuff. So I just grabbed like my recording equipment, drove up to the campus, started trying to record the band playing from a distance, and I was like, I'm not getting the sound that I want. When they finished playing, they ran over to the assistant band director, like, look, you know, is it okay if I record y'all playing X, Y, and Z? He was like, it's cool, but he was like, you probably won't speak to the official band director. I'm just the assistant. Spoke to him about it, yada, yada, yada. He was like, well, you know what? Come through to our practice sessions. It's cool. You know, you were HU alum and everything. So I'm there, I'm chilling, you know, cooling out. You know, I have brought all the kids, not kids, but brought all the students that were there. Pizza, bought like, you know, 10, 12 boxes of pizza, so they were happy. They gave me their, what they considered their best horn player, saxophone player, piano player. Once I got that, I took some of my pharmacy money. I was like, all right, cool. We're going to go to the studio down here. My man Highlight runs a studio called The Upper Room in Hampton. And we just started recording and just laying everything down. And from there, man, it just took off. And it is what it is, man.
Oh, that's what's up.
So, yeah. So, and it's also, so it's like, you know, it was all, and it's live. There's no sampling. It's all real, you know, people putting in their work from Hampton University, Norfolk State, and Howard.
That's cool. I mean, that don't happen a lot that much. A lot of this generation don't understand like that real instrumentation and how much of a difference that makes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, that's
very
what's
true.
Up. That's what's up. Pat, you feel like freestyling, don't you?
Nah. I need. You know what? I do because I always feel like, you know what I'm saying, spend a little something, but, you know, I need my, nah, that ain't gonna work, bro.
Man, see, you hate that. You,
nah.
I just watched the Fat Boys movie.
I need real live instrumentation.
Oh, okay.
Cause you
that's
know,
how you want to do it.
Copycat and it's the spice of life.
That's how you want. All right, don't even worry about it. Don't even worry about it. When I see you, have your cardboard box. Have your cardboard box when I see you.
You know what? I got Electric Boogaloo 1 and 2. So you ain't saying nothing. You ain't saying nothing.
Hey man, look. Look. Don't make me grow a Jerry curl just to be in character. Okay?
Because
I will.
Do any half period.
Alright, Doc. So when a person who's new to your poetry picks up an album, a copy of an album called Porn, even here, the title of your album, Porn, what are they actually getting out of the album versus the first thing that comes to their mind, which we know is usually sex? But what is the album, what are they, when they listen to this album, what are they coming away with as far as something that really, like something that really touched their soul?
Well, the first thing that I always tell people, when they get the album, if they've never had their socks knocked off, I tell them to put a fresh pair of socks on so that I can knock them off for them. And then what they will take away, though, honestly, aside from the insinuation that there's going to be very, like, you know, heavy, lustful, sexy type stuff going on in there, even though we do go there, it's kind of like what I said previously. It's real self-analysis, real introspection on true intimacy and evaluating the worth and the value of yourself and the person that you're with, and the importance of communication. Like, this is why it's entitled as poetry, and it's oration, rhythm, because we got the music and everything, and it's narratives. So it's like in between, you got me doing poetry. You got me flowing. You have some instrumental tracks on there. And then you got me doing narratives, you know. And so I'm acting out stuff. Like, you know, they have this one track on there called The Breakup. And I go through, like, all of the, like, step-by-step enactment of, like, a breakup. Like, you know, it's deep. Then I go into wedding vows where I talk about, like, look, this is the seriousness. Do you understand the severity and the extent of what you're about to get into, what you are pledging your life to, what you are swearing to, dedicated, committed to? Do you understand the commitment of that, what it means to you, what it means to that person, and what they're going to require? And I have a poem on there called Communication where I talk about, do we really know how to communicate? You know, oftentimes one of the biggest things that I want people to take away from the communication piece on there is that we think we're communicating, and we're not. What we do is we rely on what I call silent expectations. Like, I'm not going to say, this is what I want you to do. I'm going to say, well, because you say you love me and we're in love, I expect that you will do X, Y, and Z. And because we're in love, you should do X, Y, and Z. And it's kind of like, that's not communicating. And then if the person doesn't perform at that level, if that person doesn't meet that criteria, that person doesn't hit those standards, then you feel like they failed you. But no, really, you didn't communicate what you wanted. You didn't communicate what you needed, you know. And so these are the things that I touch on in the album that people will take away. They can extract that from the album, aside from the physical intimacy, the carnal lust, you know, that we think about when you hear porn.
Yes, sir. That's what's up. Get your mind right. Get stimulated. Not just
get your mind right and the spine. You get your mind and spine right.
There you go. There you go. That's what's up.
So, so you produce Speak On It, Mandatory Conversations for Black America, a mixtape, The Reset Button, and you blog for Dr. Boyce Watkins, Your Black World, and Financial Juneteenth website. And we just finished talking about the word of the day, which is porn.
porn.
So, what type of impact do you want to make on society? Like what are you hoping to accomplish, you know, for society and for the black community?
Good question. For me specifically, the impact that I really would like to have is I want to be that alarm clock. I want people to understand the seriousness. I want my impact to be the awakening of the times that we're in now. We're in some very serious times. So it's like outside of the poetry, outside of the music and all that, I would love people, because this is, you know, like, for instance, like I said, I wear many hats and my hands are in different pockets. There's, if you read a lot of my blogs or you listen to a lot of my podcasts on Dr. Watson's channel, I go in on several things. And we're in some serious times right now in America and globally. There is a defining moment that we're in, and we have to wake up. You know, the entertainment industry has really got us on this party and bullish. We want to turn up. We don't want to learn up. We want to turn up, and we're not seeing how important we are. We're the dawn of the 21st century. We're seeing African Americans, and I'm speaking specifically for my people. We're seeing the escorting and pushing us out of the economic table, off the economic table. We're being pushed out of jobs, not just by immigration. It's technology, robotics, artificial intelligence, software, automation, digitization. We don't understand that we're about to be displaced. We're occupationally, we're about to be gentrified with the prison industry brewing, the way the court systems are operating. Another thing that we got to look at is the loss of land. It's a global land grab that's happening. I mean, you wonder why gentrification is happening. Earth doesn't grow anymore in size. It's the haves and the have-nots. And we got to stop playing and really get about our business. That's my biggest thing. I just want people to wake up. Too much of the time, it's like social media. Oh, this is a new Twitter beef. Oh, this is a new Facebook post, Facebook war. Oh, did you see what happened at this game? You know, did you watch the game this time? Did you see what? And it's kind of like that has nothing to do with what's about to come down the pipeline. Like, I encourage people, listen, if I could drop one thing for y'all, I encourage people, while I'm here right now, go to your Google and look up the Global Futures 2045. Global Futures 2045. Research that. This is real stuff. This is a global congress that they are planning. When we talk about robotics, like, this is serious business. So that's just one gem. There is, have you brothers heard of this thing called the Svalbard Seed Repository?
No.
All right, so they have this thing called the Svalbard Seed Repository. It's over in Europe. And basically it's ran by these global elite. It's this big, how can I say it? A prison is not accurate. Let's just say it's a big warehouse, but it's encased in a mountain in this big vault. They are harvesting all of the seeds all around the world, all of the seeds for every type of plant, grain that you can think of. They're warehousing it, storing it, the original heirloom seeds. And they're saying this is a doomsday vault. So it makes you ponder the question, well, with the advent of all this GMOs, genetically modified organisms that are seeping into our agriculture and our vegetation and our produce, what are you really doing? Why do we get the GMO, but you keep all the real seeds in this vault locked inside of a mountain? You know, so that's what it is. I'll be long-winded. That's that. Just wake up. That's my thing.
Right. Two things that stood out to me, what you said. First of all, when you say that we spend too much time partying and bullshitting, which we do. You echoing the words of our friend Professor Carl Tone Jones. You know, that's what he's always saying, that people are getting mad because he says that, but it's the truth. I mean, we spend too much time trying to have fun when we're in a dire situation. You know, like they're literally, like, white supremacy is literally working on wiping us out, and we trying to have fun. So.
Oh, man. Oh, speak on it, brother. Speak on it. I mean,
yes, sir.
100% from the words of Dr. Francis Press Wilson and all angles from economics, education, entertainment, labor law, politics, religion, sex, and war, all angles we getting it. But we playing around.
Exactly.
You know, what they say with the Titanic and the band played on while the sink ship, this is what's happening.
Yes, sir. And then when you're talking about the harvesting of seeds, I just so happened to watch this movie not too long ago. It's a cartoon movie, but it's Titan A.E. And in that movie, like, they had an anime. And they had a big ship, spaceship the size of a globe or the size of a planet. And on that ship was the seed and like the sperm to recreate all types of life, like all the plant life, all the animal life, all the insect life, and all those. So you just made me think about that when you talked about them harvesting all these seeds, because they show us these things in movies, but we don't take it serious while it's really happening.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. We take it as entertainment when basically I think they're almost saying, like, we're just going to give the message to those that really know. This is the message. This is the blueprint. And for those that aren't keen, it's entertainment. Take it as you will. Mm-hmm.
Right. Exactly.
I was thinking to myself, because you were literally speaking, like, verbatim words the professor says.
I know.
Almost daily.
I know.
You know, and like Joe says, people are getting mad at him. People telling him to shut up. People are saying, I don't like watching his stuff, or I don't like this, that, and the third. And he's daily, constantly saying, these people are trying to exterminate us, and we want to do is turn up and bullshit instead of addressing the problems. And it's just, I knew about the gathering of the seeds and a couple of the other things, but I didn't know that they had I didn't know the rest of the information you gave around that, that they had a term for it, or that it was, you know, this, that, or the third. So that's interesting. But you're 100% right, and we definitely need more voices speaking out, telling people that we are in a very dire situation. I think the thing with the entertainment is we honestly believe in pure entertainment, and we don't think about the impact. Like, I think about it like, okay, if I show you something in a science fiction movie, your brain automatically files that away as fiction. So now I can do whatever I need to do really right in front of you, because you already have it in your mind that it doesn't exist and it's fiction. So you know, so there is no threat there. Like, psychologically, your mind has kind of eliminated the threat. Merely because the first time, you know, we talk about this all the time, oftentimes you believe the first impression or the first piece of information you get on the subject. It takes a mature mind to go find the second source and override that first piece. But more often than not, the very first piece of information you get is the information that you're going to run with. So if the very first piece of information you get on the subject is that the subject is bullshit, then, you know, that kind of forms like a barrier for you going out and seeing what else that subject has to offer, or any realities that might be in the realm of that subject. Anyways, this ain't your interview, Patrick. That was deep, though. I like it.
No, that was key. That was key. That was key.
Right. I mean, we said all the time, black people, white supremacy, they not playing with us. They don't like us, and they are trying to literally exterminate us. And you better wake up. Like, you better wake up.
Well, Well, I, to remind people, see, this is the thing. We get reminded and we go back to sleep. It's like we wake up and we hit the snooze button again. We wake up, we hit the snooze button again. What was the most recent wake up? Walter Scott, the guy that, the police officer that killed Walter Scott?
Yeah.
What happened? He got off because of the juror. If you look at all the killings from Sandra Bland, from this my man in New York that was choked at Eric Garner.
Yeah.
All these officers are just getting off. When we talk about with Tamir, they just get off. And if you can't see the common thread that is sewn directly down the middle, it is law enforcement on one side, it is black citizens, black bodies on the other side, and no matter what you do, whether you're innocent or not, you will be the victim, and they are going to get off. That should be the wake-up call. People need to see it, you know, and we don't see that. It's
right.
Man, we could have another conversation. We, you know, we need
exactly.
to build anyway. Like I was saying, Joseph, I was saying we need to build anyway, but yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
It's crazy. I think they don't see it because they see it too much, if that makes sense.
That does.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've seen it, so, right. They've been desensitized to it, so now it's just like when Dylan Roof gets off, or when he gets the sentence that he shouldn't get, or whatever else that happens. You know, and with that, it's a double-edged sword, because on one side, if he gets off, it's confirmation. On the other side, if he does get penalized and goes to prison, it's kind of like, well, they threw the dog a bone. So it's interesting however we look at it. The thing for me is, you know, we have too many people trying to shape white opinions of black people. So we have too many light workers, as I like to call them. Too many people that want to work in the light, that want to be seen, that want to be known as the person that changed the white opinion of black people, this, that, and the third. And we don't have enough dark workers, enough people that are putting in the work to build up the community. There are no cameras back there. There is no sunlight. You probably aren't going to get any thanks or any appreciation. But at the end of the day, it's going to be your work that saves the community. So, and I understand we need both. We need light workers and dark workers. But right now, there are way too many people trying to be light workers and not nearly enough people trying to be dark workers.
Pastor, you know, it's like what you're saying. It's kind of like the grunt work versus the stunt work. Somebody's stunting it and the other one's grunting it.
I like that.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, so, you know, as one of many poets who are privileged enough to actually get out and share your talents with the world, what makes Samori Swagger different from the other poets, and why should people support you?
Honestly, you know, the only thing that makes me different is just my life experience. I'm not one of these people, you know. A lot of people walk around with a lot of ego and bravado and machismo and things of that nature. I am only me. The only thing that I can speak on, report on, and convey and portray to the people is what I've been through, where I've been, what my eyes have seen, what my ears have heard. Whatever my five senses have picked up from the universe, and I put it out through my feelings, through my channel, my aura. That's what people are going to get. I don't have any bells and whistles and, you know, gift wrapping and you know, for sale signs and trinkets and stuff. I don't do that. My thing is I give it to you raw. I try to be as creative as I can. Like I said, with the abbreviation, alliteration, a lot of different things. I use colors and all that. You'll get that. But I just try and give it to you raw. You need food, that's what I'm going to give you. Now, some people, you know, some people will be like, okay, you need food. I'm going to give, like McDonald's. You look at a McDonald's commercial, you don't think that's the best food you ever got. Like, oh, it looks so shiny and moist and glistening and sizzling. And when you eat it, though, it's like, man, this is some manufactured bullshit.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so that's what it is to me. I only give you what I've been through, my perspective, humbly speaking, and that's the only thing that I can say. That's what I stand on.
Delicious.
Yes, sir. Porn.
Word of the day.
Porn.
It's such a wonderful word. It's so magical. So, who have been? You've dropped off a lot. So, who are some of your greatest influences?
My greatest influences, I would say, Malcolm X. The speaker, the motivational speaker, Les Brown, and my friend Danny, may he rest in peace. Malcolm X played such a big part in my development just because you could see that he came from so little and would be considered a nothing, a nobody, street thug, whatever negative connotation that you can use to describe his character at a specific point in time, you can see that under tremendous discipline, stern, stringent discipline, you can morph into a giant. You know, you can morph into a giant that can change and captivate multitudes of people.
Mm-hmm.
Les Brown played a very big role in my development, especially through pharmacy school. I didn't get turned on to Les Brown until my first year of pharmacy school. My friend Danny, that said, man, he rest in peace. This was like my homeboy that I grew up with from the sandbox. We went from elementary school together to high school together, went to Hampton. He didn't finish with me, but, you know, he went to Hampton first year. And he died in a car accident. When I was in my first year of pharmacy school, I was at work. He's with some of my boys back home in New York. They were going out to celebrate. That he was closing on his house. Called me, but I was at work. I was in the pharmacy. I was at Rite Aid Pharmacy at the time, working evening shift. And I was like, well, I'll call him when he gets off, when I get off. And then I got a call the next morning that he died in a car accident. Before he died, I was with him the week before, and he said, I want to give you this Les Brown CD, man. He was like, you know, I like what you're doing, you know. He's like, and it was so sincere. It was almost like he was signing out to me, and I didn't know what was to come. He's like, man, he's like, you know, I really love what you're doing with yourself, man. He's like, you know, you've just taken it. You've just gone, you know, from just high school to undergrad to graduate to now you're getting your doctors, you know, just, man, just take this CD and just listen to it, man. It's good. I like it. I love it, you know. And it was a week later he passed away. So I listened to the Les Brown CD, and it really changed me. It showed me a lot about staying on task, staying focused, even though you fail. When you fall, you get up, you stand up. Don't ever take a loss as a permanent thing. Always continue fighting, no matter what. And then just listen to his story of how he was considered mentally retarded, and then just to see him elevate to this man that's making multi-million dollars, you know what I'm saying, without even having a college degree. I'm like, wow, you know, and just listen to his oratory skills, it impacted me heavily. So those were to Malcolm X, Les Brown, and my boy, so that's what motivates me, my great influences.
Yes, sir. Yeah, the 10-minute Les Brown clip when he's talking about the Chinese bamboo tree. That's part of my morning routine right there.
You just got to keep water in that joint.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. And then, you know, in our circle, it's you know, we Malcolm, he's up there. Malcolm, Garvey, Claude mm-hmm. Anderson, you know, they big mm-hmm. in our circle, so we always talk. So we definitely feel you on those influences, and I'm glad we on similar wavelengths too, man, because mm-hmm. you know, we definitely who I want to talk to you again, like, because me and you were supposed to get up anyway, so we still got to get up off this line and chop it up, because we got to hook you up with the professor, man. You and the professor got to connect. So,
okay.
Because right now, he's putting out a documentary called the Independence Day Project, and I'm gonna tag you in the promo on Facebook. But the Independence Day Project basically is a documentary where getting a group of people together, and we're giving our vision of and steps to making this vision happen of what an independent black community will look like after we throw off the shackles of white supremacy. So it's like, you know, how would you know what you're working for if you don't have a vision? So we basically giving that vision of what we should be working for and why we need to throw off white supremacy.
Powerful. I love it. Yeah, tag me in that, please.
I will, and I'll definitely get you two connected. Now, we got to our final question, and this is our famous special question, and we ask everybody this question, and this is Pat's. This is his designated question. So, you know, we got to set it off a little bit like this. So, you know.
So,
all right.
So, if you were the all-powerful, all-knowing, unchallengeable ruler of black America, what would you change and what would your message to the people be?
Wow. Okay. If I was the all-powerful ruler of black, Well, first of all, my name is Samori Toure, and that's named after a West African king of Guinea. and the people in Guinea, Africa, respect that man. He fought against the French trying to colonize Guinea. I think for me, what I would change, if I was a ruler of black America, if I had the power, I would remove that spirit of competition between each other, between blacks, between African Americans, or if you want to say melanoid, whatever the descriptor you want to use of us. Remove that spirit of competition and replace it with cooperation and camaraderie. It's too much, and especially right now, and in this current moment, much of our power is dismantled because we are divided. We're always in division. We have this concept of individualism and not the group, not seeing how we can push the group forward. And I think that is the crippling problem with us. Everybody wants to be their own individual. We don't get on code. If we can work together, if we can cooperate, just completely remove that competitive spirit and replace it with a cooperative spirit, I think we would see things that we could never even imagine, because it will force us, because the question that you threw to me, I was a ruler, I could enforce this. I believe that we would definitely see a lot of changes. Because, see, the rulers of black America right now are not even black. You know, the rulers of black America is white supremacy in America. And so they control all the institutions. And so when you look at all the institutions they control, I repeated it with Dr. Francis Crutch Wilson said, we were divided and we're not really progressing. In fact, we're stagnant and we're regressing. But I think if we work together, we would see so many different ideas. You would see the creative genius come out. You would see so many different ideas, thought process, philosophies, all moving towards one thing. It's kind of like you think of fraternities and sororities. You have people from all different walks of life. You've got people online that come from well-to-do black families, people that come from, modest means financially families. You have people that are different, if you want to say different hues, shades and hues, look differently. But there's a common goal. There's a common cause. We believe in the ideals of this fraternity or this sorority. And from that, we all come together and we push. This is where you see some of the most greatest initiatives, some of the greatest accomplishments come out. Just imagine if we had all of us, well, not all of us, but you had a good portion of us focused on scientific research geared specifically towards black health, specifically towards the renaissance of black media, specifically towards education of black children, specifically towards economics. And we're all moving in one direction and one accord. Like when they say a drum line, one band, one sound. I think we'd be so much more powerful, but we don't do that. We're so divided. So that's why we falter. So that's what I would change. I would erase, I would eradicate, annihilate the competition, and I would enforce cooperation and camaraderie.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And see, a lot of people don't understand that the impact of that mindset, because we've grown up in a society that says competition brings the best out of you, and that's not necessarily true. Competition is necessary sometimes in this type of environment. You have to have a competitive spirit to survive in this type of environment, but we don't always have to exist in this type of environment. And as black people, we don't have to let other people dictate the way we exist amongst ourselves. So I definitely agree with you on that.
Yeah, I view it as within the community, you cooperate. Outside of the community, you compete. So there, I don't see anything necessarily wrong with black people as a collective competing with other groups as collectives. But when we're talking about black people interacting with black people,
cooperation.
We cooperate with each other. We're on the same team. That's like we were having the show not too long ago, Joe. We were trying to explain to people that, look, this race thing, it is just that. And you were drafted. You didn't get to pick your team. Your team chose you.
Right.
So, so it's time to play ball.
You are literally in the race.
You don't have the option to sit out, neither. That's not on it. You were born into the game, and there is no out of bounds.
Yeah. It's like, when we are explaining the concept and the true concept of race to people, and I always tell them, when you first learned the word race, how did you learn it? And for most people, it was competition. Well, for everybody, it was competition. You were racing somebody. You were competing with somebody. So I asked them, so when did the definition change? And they look at you. We're literally in a race of people that are racing against another race of people. Like, it's the competition has been laid down, the battle has been waged, and we have to get right, because we're like we said earlier, we're in a losing battle, and we're looking to have fun while we're losing this battle. So got to do better.
It's infuriating. You see it and you look at it, you listen to it. It's like you look at history, you look at, even when you think of what we're taught in American history, you go to school, you don't learn that much about black history when you go to school. But you learn about American history. When you watch American history, you think of terms they mention like manifest destiny, we just go over, we're conquistadors, we're going to conquer this. And we took over that. It's like, you don't think that stuff is still not at play. This is called a world war. World War One, World War Two. This is a struggle. We watch He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. It's called Star Wars. We have to understand, outside sports and entertainment and all this feel-good stuff, it's only meant to placate and keep us, like Nintendo said, PlayStation. We want you to stay stationed and play while we go ahead and build our dynasty, build our universe. Right. You know, it's deep, man. It's deep.
It is.
Yes, sir. I mean, you're telling the truth, and like I say, we're glad because you're even we interviewed Dr. Julius Garvey, and you're echoing the same words, and it was refreshing for him to say the things he's saying because we're not crazy, and even the elders think like this. So it's not we're the angry black people over in the corner is trying to make trouble. No, like we're literally dying. And look, let's pay attention to this Joe May Knight case just now, killed by a regular citizen, and they just let the dude walk out, no charges, no anything like that. That don't happen. That don't happen to us. If Laquan killed Hakeem, Laquan going to prison for a long time.
Yes.
But if Bob killed Hakeem, Bob get to go to Burger King.
He get to go to Burger King. You know, and he gets to go home and see his family, get to kiss his kids. He just go home and play with Fido, you know. This is what happens. The Trayvon Martin bird should have woke a lot of people up, but we woke up and went back to sleep. Like, we drugged, man. We drugged. We wake up, we go to sleep, we wake up, we press the snooze button, and I don't know.
Hey.
Sometimes it's depressing, and then, like you said, people will talk about you. They will say you're crazy. They will say you're a conspiracy theorist. You're taking it too deep. You're taking it too serious. And it's just like when people say that, you just have to cast them aside. Let them figure it out. I know that we're on an interview and time is ticking down, but I want to leave y'all with something. There was something that was very profound that Sandra Bland's mom said. Yeah, Sandra Bland's mom. She made a very interesting remark. There was I forget what was the meeting. But it was her and a couple of other mothers at this meeting. And I think the article was posted on the Griot. They had the video footage. And she said, you know, I saw and I heard about all these cases about these children being killed by police. And my heart hurt for them, but I really didn't take it serious like that until Sandra was killed. When she was killed, that's when it hit home for me. Don't let it hit home for you. And that's what it is. See, oftentimes we play, we brush it off until it hits home, until, you know, we get that 2 a.m. knock on the door by the police or you get that call at 2 a.m. in the morning. That's when it gets real. That's when reality hits home. That's when it's kind of like this is when people become convenient activists. It's convenient for you to be an activist now because it hit home for you. But where were you when the other people were getting slaughtered?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sounds like Emmett Till's mother.
Right.
Mm. Mm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. People, we got to learn from history, and we got to learn. We have to cherish people like Dr. Samara Swaggart, who's putting in the work to help uplift us and empower us, and we're all collectively working toward this independent black community. So, Doc, before we wrap this up, tell the people where they can contact you. How can they find you on social media, and what's your website, and how can they get your poetry?
Oh, yeah, sure. Thank you. So my website is www.blackladder.net. Black like the color, ladder like you climb, .net, www.blackladder.net. On Twitter, you can hit me at DocSwag06, that's DocSwagg06. My works you can find on my website, blackladder.net. I have all my stuff there. And also on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and CD Baby. You can, you know, order stuff from there. On my website, you also find my mom's publications there because she's also a great scholar and researcher. And yeah, you can hit me on there.
Yes,
that's it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Man, we definitely appreciate you coming through, kicking it with us. you know, dropping the knowledge on this man, and keep up the great work. Like, you an ill MC too. I know you. I know it's in there. I can hear it. I can feel it. I can feel that force of that MC, man. Keep doing what you're doing. We definitely got your back. We definitely here to support you. And any future projects and things that you have coming out in the future, make sure you contact us, because we definitely will help you make sure you get the word out even further. So.
Oh, definitely. You know, I love standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, just to see what's over the horizon. So,
yes, definitely. Yes, sir. So definitely appreciate you. And I will be sending you a message soon. So so we can definitely catch up offline, and I'm going to get you in contact with the professor as well.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, man. Thank you.
All right, your brothers be blessed.
Yes, sir. I want to rap now. he did it. Jamie, I see you.
Yeah, what up, man?
What it is?
No, man, I ain't want to just come in and start kicking shit, so I just put it on mute and let y'all go.
Nah, man, it's all good. How your day, man?
Man, I don't even want to talk about that, man. let's stick to the script.
That's what's up. Hey, people, remember that is Dr. Samori Swigert, and you can get his information. His website, www.blackladder.net, blackladder.net. Follow him on Twitter at DocSwag06. Make sure you visit iTunes, Amazon, CD Baby, and Google Play, as well as his website, to get some of his dope poetry and dope rhymes. I got a chance to listen to some of it, and it's real good. It's definitely real good, and you heard him, so shoot. Hey, man.
That's what's up.
Hey, man, look here. Let me ask y'all something real quick before we wrap this up, because this just been on my mind. And I don't want to sound like no asshole, but I got to ask it.
You an asshole, Joe, so be yourself.
Because this Dakota Access Pipeline thing got me mad at us, at
Ooh.
Our people. Because
Ooh.
we put more energy into their stuff than we do our own stuff. Like, our own water ain't clean. Our own people ain't staying alive. And I'm not saying that they don't need no support. I'm not saying that they stuff, that one issue is more important than the other issue. But my thing is, I see black people who do nothing for black people, who walk like, who look like they black, who smell like they black, who smell like whatever African incense they can get from the flea market. They wearing all the three, four different cultural dashikis at one time. They got the African name, all these things, but when it really come time to put in real work for black people, they're nowhere to be found. But then you look up, and they with the Dakota Access people, and it's like, well, what's wrong with y'all? Like, why can't we have this same passion and thing for ourselves? Like, do we want to see ourselves exterminated? Y'all help me out.
No, I kind of felt that way watching it. I was just like, if one thing, you know, the black community should take away from this, like, solidarity. Those people,
right.
Tribes were linking up with different tribes, it didn't matter where you from, and they stood their ground. Yeah, they had to go through it a little bit, you know, dealing this, that, and the other, but they got some results. And I'm not
right.
saying we even got to do what they did. We just got to have some type of solidarity toward some type of issue. And I think that's like you guys were talking about competition earlier. We don't want to have solidarity because it's like, yo, if you're not going to take it, I'll take it, or something like that. We got that type of mentality when all those tribes just kind of got together. It's like, yo, we all in this. Yeah, I don't even live here. I'm nowhere near it, but I support your cause. Let's all get together and be solid on this one. And hopefully people watch that and realize that, hey, with numbers, we can get some stuff done.
Yeah. Jamie's definitely right about that, because I mean, and I feel your frustration too, Joe, because I mean, you know, they're blocking the Dakota pipeline and whatnot from going through their land and the ancestral graves and all that, and you know, you want to remind, at times you just want to scream out. You do know that the World Trade Center towers were built on African burial mounds, right?
Right.
Right. African slave mounds, right? And you do know that the water in Flint is still dirty, and not just the water in Flint, but water in predominantly black neighborhoods all over the country. There are some areas, Professor says all the time, there are areas
in
Philly.
In Philly.
Where
we
the
did
water
a show
is
about that.
Bad. Yeah, we did a show about that. So, you know, but we feel so defeated that we don't, we're just like, oh, that's just the way it is. And then you see what happened with them, and then it, you know, and it wasn't, I get your frustration, Joe, because it wasn't just the Native Americans. It was like everybody came together. But at the same time, Jamie's point is very relevant. Everybody came together.
Yep.
So, and that has to start with us. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
We have to come together for our own shit and start doing things for our own shit. So we got to get rid of the ignorance first. Then we
a lot
get,
of it. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Nah, because like you said, the ignorance, and I said a lot of that is just ego.
True.
Ego.
True.
Ego. If a lot of people think, okay, I don't agree with one piece, then I can't support the whole thing because I got to agree on everything to give it support.
True.
I don't agree on a lot of stuff, but hey, if it's about the you know the movement forward of the community, what's the overall best interest of the community? Get your ass in line and let's do it. But
true,
a lot of people don't have that mentality because they got the ego part up.
Very true. Very true. Very true.
I mean,
you know, everybody want to be in charge. Nobody want to, you know, be a follower. And I think that's a lot with black people on the black community. You know, some people got to be followers. Everybody can't, you know, be the chief, this, that, and other. You just got to, you know, hey, find out where you can fit in, do your calls, and contribute to the bigger effort. And I think that's a hard part. That ego is hard to reel in sometimes.
I was going to say, even that piece about everybody wanting to be a leader is ego. Look, I've been a leader. It is not all it's cracked up to be. Trust
not
me.
At all.
Trust me. Like, if
or,
I meet
or like
somebody...
My, that, yeah, no. Now, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if I meet somebody that can work it and I can fall back, I'm going to fall back.
Straight up.
And that's the hardest thing for people to do. Like, if somebody got another idea that may be improved, maybe it's not as good as yours. But that's the idea of the group. You know, people, you know, kind of suck. They live, oh, my idea is better. F it. If everybody else want to do this, let's do this. Find out how you can contribute, make things better in the meantime. But we got to get back and not seeing each other's competition and seeing each other's allies and friends and all that kind of just simple. Can we just be friends? Hell. Like,
but,
let's
I mean,
friend zone each other first. Let's do that.
But it's like damn, people. Like, we're lit. Like, Joe McKnight, a well-known football player who...
Well-liked, too.
Right. And, like, the NFL can't even... The NFL won't help. The NFL won't even be a asset to him. Having all that fame does not trump his blackness. And he got killed by some regular, extra-regular white person. And that white person is being able to exercise that white privilege that he has over a well-known, well-liked person who you would think would have the back of a conglomerate like the NFL would have his back, but let's just be real, they don't, because he was just another meatbag that was just playing them. But it's like we play too much. We play entirely too much, and we don't get
that.
It. We make excuses for why it's okay for us to play. Like, we make it, like, when you're talking to people and you're having conversations about white supremacy and how vile white supremacy is, and then people, first thing they say, well, all white people ain't bad. Nobody said all white people ain't bad, but you can't tell me white supremacy ain't worse than you talking about all white people ain't bad. Like, we got a worse situation over here than you trying to figure out or pick through which white person is good and which white person is bad. Like, what white people are standing against white supremacy on a regular basis? Who's doing that? Like, let's not even concentrate on them. Let's just get back on ourselves. We're not doing what we're supposed to do because we either don't get it or we just don't care. And like Doc just said, most people not going to care until it's at their front door. And like, damn, do we really have to wait till it hits home, till it hits to your front door? Like it was seeing what happened to Trayvon and the people before him, that was enough for me. That was enough for me to say, I'm not going to let this come to my front door, because I understand I live in a rural southern south. And if anything happened, man, driving down some of these back roads, I just hope don't no white hoods pop up in my windows and things, because we're driving in the back roads in the swamp where anything can happen and we can get missing. And it's like it's just that serious. Like you're talking about the World Trade Center being built on a slave burial ground, like Central Park. Like they just wiped out whole black neighborhood, Central Park. You know, it used to be Seneca Village. Like nobody's trying to compare atrocities, but black people have been through the ringer. Like they drug us through the mud. They drop bombs on us. Any and everything you can think of that you shouldn't do to human beings, they've done to us, and we still got our friend out looking for solidarity and friendship with them before we do it to ourselves. And while we sit back and watch ourselves be eliminated, that's frustrating.
And a big part of that is, like, you know, through our educational years, you know, we've assimilated to this culture. We think we're, you know, a full member of this society and American culture. When it's something pop off, what's the first thing they'll say to black people? Well, if you don't like it here,
you can leave.
Go back to Africa. Yeah. They won't say go back to Africa. They'll say, well, if you don't like it here, you know, I'm pretty sure you can find another country where, you know what I'm saying? Because they don't feel 100% you know, we're a part of society as long as we're paying our taxes and we're doing, mm-hmm. we're staying within the guidelines that are set for us. But as soon as we start to push back and like, nah, this shouldn't be this way. Hey, well, hey, you can go somewhere else. So people got to understand that. And Joe, you hit it perfect, man. People play too much. Like I'm a fun loving guy. I ain't saying you got to walk around every day with three dashikis on selling bean pies and just, you know, mad as hell. You know, you can still live your life, but when it comes to these issues, people just got to learn how to think critically, accept new information, and whatever information and facts they get, apply it to your life and start changing the small things. That way, because it's small steps to start seeing people in a different light and seeing black people as your allies and your friends. That's small changes you can make within yourself. But if you're not willing to do that, then you're playing.
Straight up. Straight up. We got to get it. We got to do better, black folk. We got to do better. Who was that? This got the Eric Dickerson, football player Eric Dickerson just got his Negro wake up call. Hey, now, but see the funniest thing about that, and I got to say this before we wrap this up. The funniest thing about his Negro wake up call is he got it from the second losingest coach in NFL history. Jeff Fisher is the second. His current record right now is 4-8. In the league. He is the second losingest coach of all time. If you don't know what happened for L.A. Rams legend, the greatest player, because that's what's so funny about this, and this is what happened when black people think that white people, like white supremacy, really like them. Eric Dickerson is the greatest player in L.A. Ram history, like the greatest player. Like no other player did what he did. The second losingest coach in NFL history, Jeff Fisher, told Eric Dickerson that he's not welcome on the sideline. Like, rappers can come on the sideline. Like I can get on the sideline, but they told Eric Dickerson he can't get on the sideline. And then the management confirmed that by giving Jeff Fisher, the second losingest coach of all time in NFL history, a 4-year contract extension. So it was just like a big F you to Eric Dickerson. You just got your Negro wake-up call.
Oh, yeah. They're going to start handing them out here pretty soon to a lot of people. A lot.
Hey, they got to get right. They got to get right,
yeah,
man.
Well, the question is, did he pick up the phone or did they leave a voicemail?
Well, we're going to see. We're going to see. Either way, they told you, F you, Negro. You too dark. You darky.
A lot of people been getting their Negro wake-up calls lately, but they've been missing it. You know, they haven't picked it up. It didn't get through. Maybe got delivered to the wrong address. Maybe their phone was off. You know, who knows?
I thought.
Maybe their daughter picked it up, and she got it for them, and now she changed, but they still the same because they didn't get it. You know, who knows?
Right.
Motherfuckers been getting these calls for a minute, and they still on that same shit.
Man, they must got that call ID on, man.
I know, right? They need
we
to
got
stop
the Star 67 them, man. We got the Star 67. Then give them their way, Negro way.
Well, I ain't heard that in so long. Yes, sir. Hey, hey, all our listeners, make sure y'all remember, visit PAX Inc., P-A-C-T-S-I-N-C. PAX Inc. have developed Black Codes of Social Engineering, just codes of conduct for Black America to use to so we can have better cooperation and collaboration and actually help build as a community. So visit www.paxinc.org. And while you're on the website, just peruse the website. So much information. You spend an hour on PAX Inc. website, and you're going to learn a lot. We have a lot of black books by black authors uploaded, a lot of lectures by black lecturers uploaded, Dr. Amos Wilson, Malcolm X, Dr. Martin Luther King, just to name a few. Plus, like I said, the Black Codes of Social Engineering, and you can learn more about PAX Inc. Also visit www.wauwhataboutus.com so you can learn more about the Independence Day Project, which is a vision for the black community, for how the black community would be, what the existence of black community would be once we are existing amongst ourselves in an independent black community. And that's brought to you by the Professor Carlton Jones. And y'all make sure you all go to wauwhataboutus.com. And also, last but not least, visit my website, ontheshouldersone.com. That's the ontheshouldersone.com to support my black history blog. Also, get you a copy of my book, On the Shoulders of Giants, Volume 1, North America, where I'm profiling 10 sung and unsung heroes of the African diaspora who've made significant contributions here in North America. And also, my app, my African History Curriculum app, is coming out on December 15th, and it'll be available on my website, which is once again www.ontheshouldersone.com. So, you know, support. And really, really, really go look at those codes of conduct on PAX Inc. Website. Anything else y'all boys wanna lace on the track?
Ah, man, you did all the plugs, man. Look out for my new shoe line coming out called Socks. Check it out.
There you go. And
no,
what's
I just
our
made that up, and it was terrible. let me stop. People don't look for that. That's terrible. That was a terrible idea. I should have said that. I recant my whole mess.
What's our word for the day?
Porn.
Jamie.
Yeah, shout out to Pat trying to get porn taken off the internet. You're an evil-ass bastard,
not,
Pat. Yeah, he did.
I did not.
Pat's anti-porn, people.
I'm looking at Pornhub right now. What are you talking about?
Pat, don't let him fool you, man. He's
why you can't look at West Coast Productions? Why you can't look at no black porn?
He's against Ghetto Gaggers. all of it, man. He's against
Black Street Hookers, huh?
Yeah, he's against all types of porn. Pat is a damn communist.
I'm
starting that rumor here today.
I'm only against porn that uses the tag sexy black mom. I'm against
there you
all
go.
Those
there you go. Hey, we'll see y'all next week, man. Y'all stay strapped, stay blessed, stay black. Peace.